This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Sam Walton, Made in America, by Sam Walton with John Huey. Narrated by Henry Strozier. Forward. Hello, friends. I'm Sam Walton, founder and chairman of Walmart Stores. By now, I hope you've shopped in one of our stores, or maybe bought some stock in our company. If you have, you probably already know how proud I am of what is simply the miracle that all these Walmart associates of mine have accomplished in the 30 years since we opened our first Walmart here in Northwest Arkansas, which Walmart and I still call home. As hard as it is to believe sometimes, we've grown from that one little store into what is now the largest retailing outfit in the world. And we've really had a heck of a time along the way. I realize we've been through something amazing here at Walmart, something special that we ought to share more of with all the folks who've been so loyal to our stores and to our company. That's one thing we never did much of while we were building Walmart, talk about ourselves or do a whole lot of bragging outside the Walmart family. Except when we had to convince some banker or some Wall Street financier that we intended to amount to something someday, that we were worth taking a chance on. When folks have asked me, how did Walmart do it? I've usually been flip about answering them. Friend, we just got after it and stayed after it, I'd say. We've always pretty much kept to ourselves, and we've had good reasons for it. We've been very protective of our business dealings and our home lives, and we still like it that way. But as a result, a whole lot of misinformation and myth and half-truths have gotten around over the years about me and about Walmart. And I think there's been way too much attention paid to my personal finances, attention that has caused me and my family a lot of extra trouble in our lives, though I've just ignored it and pretty much gone about my life in the business of Walmart as best I could. None of this has really changed, but I've been fighting cancer for a while now, and I'm not getting any younger anyway. And lately a lot of folks, including Helen and the kids, some of our executives here at the company, and even some of the associates in our stores, have been fussing at me that I'm really the best person to tell the Walmart tale, and that, like it or not, my life is all wrapped up in Walmart, and I should get it down right while I still can. So I'm going to try to tell this story the best I'm able to, as close to the way it all came about as I can, and I hope it will be almost as interesting and fun and exciting as it's been for all of us, and that it can capture for you at least something of the spirit we've all felt in building this company. More than anything, though, I want to get across once and for all just how important Walmart's associates have been to its success. This is a funny thing to do, this looking back on your life, trying to figure out how all the pieces came together. I guess anybody would find it a little strange, but it's really odd for somebody like me, because I've never been a very reflective fellow, never been one to dwell in the past. If I had to single out one element in my life that has made a difference for me, it would be a passion to compete. That passion has pretty much kept me on the go, looking ahead to the next store visit, or the next store opening, or the next merchandising item I personally wanted to promote out in those stores, like a minnow bucket, or a thermos bottle, or a mattress pad, or a big bag of candy. As I do look back, though, I realize that ours is a story about the kinds of traditional principles that made America great in the first place. It is a story about entrepreneurship and risk and hard work, and knowing where you want to go and being willing to do what it takes to get there. It's a story about believing in your idea even when maybe some other folks don't, and about sticking to your guns, But I think more than anything, it proves there's absolutely no limit to what plain, ordinary working people can accomplish if they're given the opportunity and the encouragement and the incentive to do their best. Because that's how Walmart became Walmart. Ordinary people joined together to accomplish extraordinary things. At first, we amazed ourselves. And before too long, we amazed everybody else, especially folks who thought America was just too complicated and sophisticated a place for this sort of thing to work anymore. The Walmart story is unique. Nothing quite like it has been done before. So maybe by telling it the way it really happened, we can help some other folks down the line take these same principles and apply them to their dreams and make them come true. Chapter 1. Learning to Value a Dollar. A quote from Helen Williams, former history and speech teacher at Hickman High School in Columbia, Missouri. I was awake one night and turned on my radio, and I heard them announce that Sam Walton was the richest man in America. And I thought, Sam Walton? Why, he was in my class. And I got so excited. Success has always had its price, I guess, and I learned that lesson the hard way in October of 1985 when Forbes magazine named me the so-called richest man in America. Well, it wasn't too hard to imagine all those newspaper and TV folks up in New York saying, "Who? And he lives where?" The next thing we knew, reporters and photographers started flocking down here to Bentonville, I guess to take pictures of me diving into some swimming pool full of money they imagined I had, or to watch me light big fat cigars with $100 bills while the Hoochie Coochie girls danced by the lake. I really don't know what they thought, but I wasn't about to cooperate with them. So they found out all these exciting things about me, like I drove an old pickup truck with cages in the back for my bird dogs, or I wore a Walmart ball cap, or I got my hair cut at the barbershop just off the town square. Somebody with a telephoto lens even snuck up and took a picture of me in the barber chair, and it was in newspapers all over the country. Then folks we'd never heard of started calling us and writing us from all over the world and coming here to ask us for money. Many of them represented worthy causes, I'm sure, but we also heard from just about every harebrained cockamamie schemer in the world. I remember one letter from a woman who just came right out and said, "I've never been able to afford the $100,000 house I've always wanted. Will you give me the money?" They still do it to this day. Write or call asking for a new car or money to go on a vacation or to get some dental work. Whatever comes into their minds. Now, I'm a friendly fellow by nature. I always speak to folks in the street and such. And my wife, Helen, is as genial and outgoing as she can be, involved in all sorts of community activities, and we've always lived very much out in the open. But we really thought there for a while that this richest thing was going to ruin our whole lifestyle. We've always tried to do our share, but all of a sudden everybody expected us to pay their way, too. And nosy people from the media would call our house at all hours and get downright rude when we'd tell them, "No, you can't bring a TV crew out to the house." Or, "No, we don't want your magazine to spend a week photographing the lives of the Waltons." Or, "No, I don't have time to share my life story with you." It made me mad, anyway, that all they wanted to talk about was my family's personal finances. They weren't even interested in Walmart, which was probably one of the best business stories going on anywhere in the world at the time, but it never even occurred to them to ask about the company. The impression I got is that most media folks, and some Wall Street types too, either thought we were just a bunch of bumpkins selling socks off the back of a truck, or that we were some kind of fast buck artist or stock scammers. And when they did write about the company, they either got it wrong or just made fun of us. So the Walton family almost instinctively put a pretty tight lid on personal publicity for any of us. although we kept living out in the open and going around visiting folks in the stores all the time. Fortunately, here in Bentonville, our friends and neighbors protected us from a lot of these scavengers. But I did get ambushed by the lifestyles of the rich and famous guy at a tennis tournament I was playing in, and Helen talked to one of the women's magazines for an article. The media usually portrayed me as a really cheap, eccentric recluse, sort of a hillbilly who more or less slept with his dogs in spite of having billions of dollars stashed away in a cave. Then when the stock market crashed in 1987, and Walmart's stock dropped along with everything else in the market, everybody wrote that I'd lost $500 million. When they asked me about it, I said, "It's only paper." And they had a good time with that. But now I'd like to explain some of my attitudes about money, up to a point. After that, our finances, like those of any other normal-thinking American family, are nobody's business but our own. No question about it, a lot of my attitude toward money stems from growing up during a pretty hard-scrabble time in our country's history, the Great Depression. And this heartland area we come from out here, Missouri, Oklahoma, Kansas, Arkansas, was hard hit during that Dust Bowl era. I was born in Kingfisher, Oklahoma in 1918 and lived there until I was about five. But my earliest memories are of Springfield, Missouri, where I started school, and later of the little Missouri town of Marshall. After that, we lived in Shelbina, Missouri, where I started high school, and still later Columbia, where I finished high school and went on to college. My dad, Thomas Gibson Walton, was an awfully hard worker who got up early, put in long hours, and was honest. Completely, totally honest. Remembered by most people for his integrity. He was also a bit of a character who loved to trade, loved to make a deal for just about anything. Horses, mules, cattle, houses, farms, cars, anything. Once he traded our farm in Kingfisher for another one near Omega, Oklahoma. Another time he traded his wristwatch for a hog, so we'd have meat on the table. And he was the best negotiator I ever ran into. My dad had that unusual instinct to know how far he could go with someone, and did it in a way that he and the guy always parted friends. But he would embarrass me with some of the offers he would make. They were so low. That's one reason I'm probably not the best negotiator in the world. I lack the ability to squeeze that last dollar. Fortunately, my brother Bud, who has been my partner from early on, inherited my dad's ability to negotiate. Dad never had the kind of ambition or confidence to build much of a business on his own, and he didn't believe in taking on debt. When I was growing up, he had all sorts of jobs. He was a banker and a farmer and a farm loan appraiser and an agent for both insurance and real estate. For a few months, early in the Depression, he was out of work altogether, and eventually he went to work for his brother's Walton Mortgage Company, which was an agent for Metropolitan Life Insurance. Dad became the guy who had to service Metropolitan's old farm loans, most of which were in default. And 29 and 30 and 31, he had to repossess hundreds of farms from wonderful people whose families had owned the land forever. I traveled with him some, and it was tragic and really hard on Dad, too. But he tried to do it in a way that left those farmers with as much of their self-respect as he could. All of this must have made an impression on me as a kid, although I don't ever remember saying anything to myself like, "I'll never be poor." We never thought of ourselves as poor, although we certainly didn't have much of what you'd call disposable income lying around, and we did what we could to raise a dollar here and there. For example, my mother, Nan Walton, got the idea during the Depression to start a little milk business. Mother would prepare and bottle the milk, and I'd deliver it after football practice in the afternoons. We had 10 or 12 customers who paid 10 cents a gallon. Best of all, Mother would skim the cream and make ice cream. And it's a wonder I wasn't known as Fat Sam Walton in those days from all the ice cream I ate. I also started selling magazine subscriptions, probably as young as 7 or 8 years old, and I had paper routes from the 7th grade all the way through college. I raised and sold rabbits and pigeons, too, nothing really unusual for country boys of that era. I learned from a very early age that it was important for us kids to help provide for the home, to be contributors rather than just takers. In the process, of course, we learned how much hard work it took to get your hands on a dollar, and that when you did, it was worth something. One thing my mother and dad shared completely was their approach to money. They just didn't spend it. Bud Walton. People can't understand why we're still so conservative. They make a big deal about Sam being a billionaire and driving an old pickup truck or buying his clothes at Walmart or refusing to fly first class. It's just the way we were brought up. When a penny is lying out there in the street, how many people would go out there and pick it up? I bet I would, and I know Sam would. Stephen Pumphrey, photographer. Once I was setting up to photograph Sam out on the tarmac of some little airport in Missouri. He was over filing a flight plan, and I threw a nickel down on the pavement, trying to be cute, and said to my assistant, "Let's see if he picks it up." Planes are landing and taking off, and Sam comes walking over in a big hurry, a little put out that he has to pose for another picture. "Okay," he says, "where do you want me to stand? On that nickel?" By the time I got out in the world ready to make something of myself, I already had a strongly ingrained respect for the value of a dollar. But my knowledge about money and finances probably wasn't all that sophisticated, in spite of the business degree I had. Then I got to know Helen's family, and listening to her father, L.S. Robson, was an education in itself. He influenced me a great deal. He was a great salesman, one of the most persuasive individuals I have ever met. And I'm sure his success as a trader and a businessman, his knowledge of finance and the law, and his philosophy had a big effect on me. My competitive nature was such that I saw his success and admired it. I didn't envy it, I admired it. I said to myself, maybe I will be as successful as he is someday. The Robsons were very smart about the way they handled their finances. Helen's father organized his ranch and family businesses as a partnership, and Helen and her brothers were all partners. They all took turns doing the ranch books and things like that. Helen has a B.S. degree in finance, which back then was really unusual for a woman. Anyway, Mr. Robson advised us to do the same thing with our family, and we did, way back in 1953. What little we had at the time we put into a partnership with our kids, which was later incorporated into Walton Enterprises. Over the years, our Walmart stock has gone into that partnership. Then the board of Walton Enterprises, which is us, the family, makes decisions on a consensus basis. Sometimes we argue and sometimes we don't, but we control the amount we pay out to each of us, and everybody gets the same. The kids got as much over the years as Helen and I did, except I got a salary, which my son Jim now draws as head of Walton Enterprises. That way we accumulated funds and enterprises rather than throwing it all over the place to live high. And we certainly drew all we needed, probably more, in my opinion. The partnership works in a number of different ways. First, it enables us to control Walmart through the family and keep it together, rather than having it sold off in pieces haphazardly. We still own 38% of the company's stock today, which is an unusually large stake for anyone to hold in an outfit the size of Walmart. And that's the best protection there is against the takeover raiders. It's something that any family who has faith in its strength as a unit and in the growth potential of its business can do. The transfer of ownership was made so long ago that we didn't have to pay substantial gift or inheritance taxes on it. The principle behind this is simple. The best way to reduce paying estate taxes is to give your assets away before they appreciate. It turned out to be a great philosophy and a great strategy. And I certainly wouldn't have figured it out way back then without the advice of Helen's father. It wasn't lavish or exorbitant, and that was part of the plan, to keep the family together as well as maintain a sense of balance in our standards. Helen Walton. It was great money-wise, but there was another aspect to it, the relationship that was established among the children and with the family. It developed their sense of responsibility toward one another. You just can't beat that. So along comes Forbes in 1985 and says, I'm the richest man in America. Well, there's no question that if you multiply the Walmart stock price by how much we own, then maybe we are worth $20 or $25 billion, or whatever they say. The family may have those kinds of assets, but I've never seen that myself. For one thing, Helen and I only own 20% of our family's total interest in Walmart. For another, as long as I have anything to do with it, and I'm confident this attitude will last at least another generation, most of that Walmart stock is staying right where it is. We don't need the money. We don't need to buy a yacht. And thank goodness we never thought we had to go out and buy anything like an island. We just don't have those kinds of needs or ambitions, which wreck a lot of companies when they get along in years. Some families sell their stock off a little at a time to live high, and then boom, somebody takes them over, and it all goes down the drain. One of the real reasons I'm writing this book is so my grandchildren and great-grandchildren will read it years from now and know this. If you start any of that foolishness, I'll come back and haunt you. So don't even think about it. Not that I'm trying to poor mouth here. We certainly have had more than adequate funds in this family for a long time, even before we got Walmart cranked up. Here's the thing. Money never has meant that much to me, not even in the sense of keeping score. If we had enough groceries and a nice place to live, plenty of room to keep and feed my bird dogs, a place to hunt, a place to play tennis, and the means to get the kids good educations, that's rich. No question about it. And we have it. We're not crazy. We don't live like paupers the way some people depict us. We all love to fly, and we have nice airplanes. But I've owned about 18 airplanes over the years, and I never bought one of them new. We have our family meetings at fine places like the Ritz-Carlton in Naples, Florida, or the Del Coronado in San Diego. This house we live in was designed by E. Fay Jones, who lives down the road in Fayetteville, and is a world-famous disciple of Frank Lloyd Wright. And even though I think it costs too much, I have to admit that it's beautiful. But in a real, simple, natural kind of way. We're not ashamed of having money, but I just don't believe a big showy lifestyle is appropriate for anywhere. Least of all here in Bentonville, where folks work hard for their money, and where we all know that everyone puts on their trousers one leg at a time. I'm not sure I ever really figured out this celebrity business. Now, why in the world, for example, would I get an invitation to Elizabeth Taylor's wedding out in Hollywood? I still can't believe it was news that I get my hair cut at the barber shop. Where else would I get it cut? Why do I drive a pickup truck? What am I supposed to haul my dogs around in, a Rolls Royce? Nowadays, I'm willing to concede that some good may have come from that magazine article and all the hubbub it created, as much as I hated it for years. At first, I thought it was going to be bad for my relationship with the associates in the stores, but I found out that, gosh, they almost looked at it like, look, we helped him get there. Good for him. I think my coming by to visit the stores somehow means more to them now. I noticed a big difference in their reaction since that list made me into sort of a public figure. And, of course, our customers seem to get a kick out of it, too, asking me to autograph dollar bills and other stuff. Charlie Baum, early Walmart partner. I've known Sam since his first store in Newport, Arkansas, and I believe that money is, in some respects, almost immaterial to him. What motivates the man is the desire to absolutely be on top of the heap. It is not money. Money drives him crazy now. His question to me at 6 a.m. not long ago was, how do you inspire a grandchild to go to work if they know they'll never have a poor day in their life? David Glass, CEO, Walmart. Does Sam have money? I've been traveling with him for 30 years, and you could never tell it by me. In fact, if I didn't read the proxy statement every year, I'd swear he was broke. I remember one time we were flying out of New York on a commercial flight going to see our friends at the Limited in Columbus, Ohio, and all of a sudden at the airport, Sam sort of looks startled and says, David, I don't have any money with me. Do you? I reached in my wallet and pulled out 2 20s. He looked at them and said, you won't need both of these. Let me borrow one. Now, when it comes to Walmart, there's no two ways about it. I'm cheap. I think it's a real statement that Walmart never bought a jet until after we were approaching $40 billion in sales and expanded as far away as California and Maine. And even then, they had to practically tie me up and hold me down to do it. On the road, we sleep 2 to a room, although as I've gotten older, I have finally started staying in my own room. We stay in Holiday Inns and Ramada Inns and Days Inns, and we eat a lot at family restaurants when we have time to eat. A lot of what goes on these days with high-flying companies and these overpaid CEOs who are really just looting from the top and aren't watching out for anybody but themselves, really upsets me. It's one of the main things wrong with American business today. Gary Reinboth, early store manager, Walmart. In those days, we would go on these buying trips with Sam, and we'd all stay as much as we could in one room or two. I remember one time in Chicago when we stayed 8 of us to a room, and the room wasn't very big to begin with. You might say we were on a pretty restricted budget. But sometimes I'm asked why today, when Walmart has been so successful, when we're a $50 billion-plus company, should we stay so cheap? Well, that's simple, because we believe in the value of the dollar. We exist to provide value to our customers, which means that in addition to quality and service, we have to save them money. Every time Walmart spends $1 foolishly, it comes right out of our customers' pockets. Every time we save them a dollar, that puts us one more step ahead of the competition, which is where we always plan to be. Chapter 2. Starting on a Dime. A quote from Bud Walton. From the time we were kids, Sam could excel at anything he set his mind to. I guess it's just the way he was born. Back when he carried newspapers, they had a contest. I've forgotten what the prizes were, maybe $10, who knows. He won that contest, going out selling new subscriptions door to door. And he knew he was going to win. It's just the makeup of the man. My only explanation is that Sam has a lot of our mother's characteristics. I don't know what causes a person to be ambitious, but it is a fact that I have been overblessed with drive and ambition from the time I hit the ground. And I expect my brother's probably right. Our mother was extremely ambitious for her kids. She read a lot and loved education, although she didn't have too much herself. She went to college for a year before she quit to get married, and maybe to compensate for that, she just ordained from the beginning that I would go to college and make something of myself. One of the great sadnesses in my life is that she died young of cancer, just as we were beginning to do well in business. Mother must have been a pretty special motivator, because I took her seriously when she told me I should always try to be the best I could at whatever I took on. So I have always pursued everything I was interested in with a true passion. Some would say obsession, to win. I've always held the bar pretty high for myself. I've set extremely high personal goals. Even when I was a little kid in Marshall, Missouri, I remember being ambitious. I was a class officer several years. I played football and baseball and basketball with the other kids, and I swam in the summers. I was so competitive that when I started Boy Scouts in Marshall, I made a bet with the other guys about which one of us would be the first to reach the rank of Eagle. Before I made Eagle in Marshall, we had moved to the little town of Shelbina, Missouri, population maybe 1,500, but I won the bet. I got my Eagle at age 13, the youngest Eagle Scout in the history of the state of Missouri at that time. From the Shelbina Democrat, summer 1932. Because of his training in Boy Scout work, Sammy Walton, 14-year-old son of Mr. and Mrs. Tom Walton of Shelbina, rescued Donald Peterson, little son of Professor and Mrs. K.R. Peterson, from drowning in Salt River Thursday afternoon. Donald got into water too deep for him and called for help. Lloyd Jones, who had accompanied the boys, made an effort to get him out, but Donald's struggles pulled Mr. Jones down several times. Young Walton, who was some distance away, got to the pair just as Donald went down a fifth time. He grasped him from behind, as he had been taught to do, pulled him to shore, and applied artificial respiration that scouts must become proficient in. Donald was unconscious, and his whole body had turned blue. It took quite a while to bring him around. They said I saved his life. Maybe yes, maybe no. Newspapers tend to exaggerate these things, but at least I got him out of the water. Looking back on such boyhood episodes helps me to realize now that I've always had a strong bias toward action, a trait that has been a big part of the Walmart story. Truthfully, though, talking about this embarrasses me a good bit because I worry that it seems like I'm bragging or trying to make myself out to be some big hero. It particularly bothers me because I learned a long time ago that exercising your ego in public is definitely not the way to build an effective organization. One person seeking glory doesn't accomplish much. At Walmart, everything we've done has been the result of people pulling together to meet one common goal, teamwork, something I also picked up at an early age. Team play began for me when I was in the fifth grade, and a friend of mine's dad organized a bunch of us into a pee-wee football team. We competed against other towns like Odessa and Sedalia and Richmond. I played end, but I wanted to throw the ball or be a running back, even though I was a little guy and couldn't squeeze my way in yet. Team athletics remained a big part of my life all through high school and at the intramural level in college, too. By the time we moved to Shelbina, I had more football experience than most of the other kids in the ninth grade, so I was able to make the team as a second-string quarterback. I was still small, only about 130 pounds, but I knew a lot about blocking and tackling and throwing the ball, and by being extremely competitive, I got my letter. Then we moved on again, this time to Columbia, Missouri. There, at Hickman High School, I got involved in just about everything. I wasn't what you'd call a gifted student, but I worked really hard and made the honor roll. I was president of the student body and active in a lot of clubs. I remember the speech club in particular, and I was voted most versatile boy. I was really a gym rat. I loved hanging around that gym playing basketball. But I didn't go out for the team, maybe because I was only 5'9". When I was a senior, though, they drafted me for the team, and I became a guard, sometimes a starter. I wasn't a great shot, but I was a pretty good ball handler and a real good floor leader. I liked running the team, I guess. We went undefeated, and in one of my biggest thrills, won the state championship. My high school athletic experience was really unbelievable because I was also the quarterback on the football team, which went undefeated too, and won the state championship as well. I didn't throw particularly well, but we were mostly a running team. And I was fairly slow for a back, but I was shifty, sometimes so shifty that I would fall down with a bunch of daylight in front of me. On defense, my favorite thing was when the coach would slip me in and let me play linebacker. I had a good sense for where the ball was going to go, and I really loved to hit. I guess I was just totally competitive as an athlete, and my main talent was probably the same as my best talent as a retailer. I was a good motivator. This is hard to believe, but it's true. In my whole life, I never played in a losing football game. I certainly can't take much of the credit for that, and in fact, there was definitely some luck involved. I was sick or injured for a couple of games that we wouldn't have won with or without me, so I dodged the bullet on a few losses that I could have played in, but I think that record had an important effect on me. It taught me to expect to win, to go into tough challenges always planning to come out victorious. Later on in life, I think Kmart, or whatever competition we were facing, just became Jeff City High School, the team we played for the state championship in 1935. It never occurred to me that I might lose. To me, it was almost as if I had a right to win. Thinking like that often seems to turn into sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Having been the quarterback for the Hickman Cupies, the undefeated state champions, I was already pretty well known around Columbia, where the University of Missouri is located, so my high school career just merged right on into college. Most of the fraternities were really for the more well-to-do kids, and I ordinarily wouldn't have qualified for membership. But they rushed me, even as a town boy, and I had my pick of the best. I chose Beta Theta Pi because they were the top scholastic fraternity and had led the Intramural Athletic League for a number of years. When I was a sophomore, the Betas made me rush captain. So I bought a real old Ford, and I traveled the whole state that summer interviewing potential Beta candidates. With all this competitive spirit and ambition I had back then, I even entertained thoughts of one day becoming President of the United States. Closer at hand, I had decided I wanted to be president of the university student body. I learned early on that one of the secrets to campus leadership was the simplest thing of all. Speak to people coming down the sidewalk before they speak to you. I did that in college. I did it when I carried my papers. I would always look ahead and speak to the person coming toward me. If I knew them, I would call them by name, but even if I didn't, I would still speak to them. Before long, I probably knew more students than anybody in the university, and they recognized me and considered me their friend. I ran for every office that came along. I was elected president of the Senior Men's Honor Society, QEBH, an officer in my fraternity, and president of the senior class. I was captain and president of Scabbard and Blade, the elite military organization of ROTC. From an article called Hustler Walton in Fraternity Newspaper, 1940. Sam is one of those rare people who knows every janitor by name, passes plates in church, loves to join organizations. Sam's ability to lead has been the cause of much ribbing. His military uniform has let him be called Little Caesar. For his presidency of the Bible class, he suffered the nickname Deacon. Also, while I was at Missouri, I was elected president of the Burrell Bible class, a huge class made up of students from both Missouri and Stevens College. Growing up, I had always gone to church and Sunday school every Sunday. It was an important part of my life. I don't know that I was that religious, per se, but I always felt like the church was important. Obviously, I enjoyed running for office during my college years. But aside from dabbling in some city council politics years later, I really left my ambitions for elected office on the college campus. I was about to graduate from the University of Missouri in June of 1940 with a business degree, and I had been working probably as hard as I ever worked in my life. I've always had lots of energy, but I was tired. Ever since high school, I had made all my own money and paid for all my own clothes. That continued in college, except I had to add tuition and food and fraternity dues and date money to my expenses. Dad and Mother would have been glad to help if they could have, but it was the Depression, and they had no extra money at all. I had continued to throw a newspaper route all through high school, and in college I added a few more routes, hired a few helpers, and turned it into a pretty good business. I made about $4,000 to $5,000 a year, which at the end of the Depression was fairly serious money. Ezra Entrekin, former circulation manager of the Columbia Missourian. We hired Sam to deliver newspapers, and he really became our chief salesman. When school started, we had a drive to get the kids in the fraternities and sororities to subscribe. And Sam was the boy we had do that because he could sell more than anybody else. He was good. He was really good and dedicated. And he did a lot of other things besides deliver newspapers. In fact, he was a little bit scatterbrained at times. He'd have so many things going, he'd almost forget one. But boy, when he focused on something, that was it. In addition to the newspapers, I waited tables in exchange for meals, and I was also the head lifeguard in charge of the swimming pool. You can see that I was a pretty busy fellow, and you can see why my notorious respect for the value of a dollar continued. But now that I was about to become a college graduate, I was ready to give up this routine, really eager to get out in the world and make something of myself in a real job. My first exposure to the possibilities of retail had come in 1939, when our family happened to move next door to a guy named Hugh Mattingly. He'd been a barber in Odessa, Missouri, before he and his brother started a variety store chain, which had grown to around 60 stores by that time. I would talk with him about merchandising, how to do it, and how well it was working out for him. He took an interest in me and later even offered me a job. But I never seriously considered retail in those days. In fact, I was sure I was going to be an insurance salesman. I had a high school girlfriend whose father was a very successful salesman for General American Life Insurance Company, and I had talked to him about his business. It appeared to me that he was making all the money in the world. Insurance seemed like a natural for me because I thought I could sell. I'd always sold things. As a little kid, I sold Liberty magazine for a nickel and then switched to Woman's Home Companion when it came along for a dime, figuring I could make twice as much money. The girl and I broke up, but I still had big plans. I figured I would get my degree and go on to the Wharton School of Finance in Pennsylvania. But as college wound down, I realized that even if I kept up the same kind of work routine I had had all through college, I still wouldn't have the money to go to Wharton. So I decided to cash in what chips I already had, and I visited with two company recruiters who had come to the Missouri campus. Both of them made me job offers. I accepted the one from J.C. Penney. I turned down the one from Sears Roebuck. Now I realize the simple truth. I got into retailing because I was tired and I wanted a real job. The deal was pretty straightforward. Report to the J.C. Penney store in Des Moines, Iowa, 3 days after graduation, June 3, 1940, and begin work as a management trainee. Salary, $75 a month. That's the day I went into retail. And, except for a little time out as an Army officer, that's where I've stayed for the last 52 years. Maybe I was born to be a merchant. Maybe it was fate. I don't know about that kind of stuff. But I know this for sure. I loved retail from the very beginning, and I still love it today. Not that it went all that smooth right off the bat. Like I said, I could sell, and I loved that part. Unfortunately, I never learned handwriting all that well. Helen says there are only about 5 people in the world who can read my chicken scratch. She's not one of them. And this began to cause some problems for me at my new job. Penny's had a fellow out of New York named Blake, who traveled around the country auditing stores and evaluating personnel and whatnot, and he would come to see us pretty regularly. I remember him as a big fellow over 6 feet who always dressed to the nines, you know, Penny's best suits and shirts and ties. Anyway, he'd get all upset at the way I would screw up the sales slips and generally mishandle the cash register part of things. I couldn't stand to leave a new customer waiting while I fiddled with paperwork on a sale I'd already made, and I have to admit it did create some confusion. "Walton," Blake would say to me when he came to Des Moines, "I'd fire you if you weren't such a good salesman. Maybe you're just not cut out for retail." Fortunately, I found a champion in my store manager, Duncan Majors, a great motivator, who was proudest of having trained more Penny managers than anybody else in the country. He had his own techniques and was a very successful manager. His secret was that he worked us from 6:30 in the morning until 7 or 8 o'clock at night. All of us wanted to become managers like him. On Sundays, when we weren't working, we would go out to his house. There were about 8 of us, all men, and we would talk about retailing, of course, but we also played ping pong or cards. It was a 7-day job. I remember one Sunday, Duncan Majors had just gotten his annual bonus check from Penny's and was waving it around all over the place. It was for $65,000, which impressed the heck out of us boys. Watching this guy is what got me excited about retail. He was really good. Then, of course, the icing on the cake was when James Cash Penny himself visited the store one day. He didn't get around to his stores as often as I would later on, but he did get around. I still remember him showing me how to tie and package merchandise, how to wrap it with very little twine and very little paper, but still make it look nice. I worked for Penny's about 18 months, and they really were the Cadillac of the industry, as far as I was concerned. But even back then, I was checking out the competition. The intersection where I worked in Des Moines had 3 stores, so at lunch I would always go wander around the Sears and the Yonkers stores to see what they were up to. By early 1942, though, the war was on, and as an ROTC graduate, I was gung-ho to go, ready to ship out overseas and see my share of the action. But the Army had a big surprise for me. Because of a minor heart irregularity, I flunked the physical for combat duty and was classified for limited duty. This kind of got me down in the dumps, and since I was just waiting around to be called up anyway, I quit my Penny's job and wandered south toward Tulsa with some vague idea of seeing what the oil business was like. Instead, I got a job at a big DuPont gunpowder plant in the town of Pryor, outside Tulsa. The only room I could find to stay in was nearby over in Claremore. That's where I met Helen Robson one April night in a bowling alley. Helen Walton. I was out on a date with another fellow, and it was the first time I'd ever been bowling. I had just rolled the ball, and when I came back to the seats, they were those old wooden theater chairs. Sam had his leg up over the armrest of one of them, and he smiled at me and said, corny as it was, "Haven't I met you somewhere before?" We discovered that he had dated a girl I knew in college. Later on, he called me and asked me for her number, and I think maybe he even went out with her. But pretty soon, he and I were going out together. My whole family just fell in love with him, and I always said he fell in love as much with my family as he did with me. When Helen and I met and I started courting her, I just fell right in love. She was pretty and smart and educated, ambitious and opinionated and strong-willed, with ideas and plans of her own. Also, like me, she was an athlete who loved the outdoors, and she had lots of energy. Helen Walton. I always told my mother and dad that I was going to marry someone who had that special energy and drive, that desire to be a success. I certainly found what I was looking for, but now I laugh sometimes and say maybe I overshot a little. At the same time Helen and I fell for each other, I was finally called up to the Army for active duty. Because of my heart irregularity, I couldn't see combat, but I was still able to accept my ROTC commission as a second lieutenant. By the time I went into the Army, I had two things settled. I knew who I wanted to marry, and I knew what I wanted to do for a living, retailing. About a year after I went into the Army, Helen and I were married on Valentine's Day, 1943, in her hometown of Claremore, Oklahoma. I wish I could recount a valiant military career like my brother Bud, who was a Navy bomber pilot on a carrier in the Pacific, but my service stint was really fairly ordinary time spent as a lieutenant and then as a captain, doing things like supervising security at aircraft plants and POW camps in California and around the country. Helen and I spent 2 years living the Army life, and when I got out in 1945, I not only knew I wanted to go into retailing, I also knew I wanted to go into business for myself. My only experience was the penny job, but I had a lot of confidence that I could be successful on my own. Our last Army posting was in Salt Lake City, and I went to the library there and checked out every book on retailing. I also spent a lot of my off-duty time studying ZCMI, the Mormon Church's department store out there, just figuring that when I got back to civilian life, I would somehow go into the department store business. The only question left was where we were going to set up housekeeping. Helen Walton. My father wanted us to move to Claremore, but I told him, Dad, I want my husband to be himself. I don't want him to be L.S. Robson's son-in-law. I want him to be Sam Walton. As I mentioned, Helen's father was a very prominent lawyer, banker, and rancher, and she felt we should be independent. I agreed with her, and I thought our best opportunity might be in St. Louis. As it turned out, an old friend of mine, Tom Bates, also wanted to go into the department store business. I had known Tom when we were kids in Shelbina. His father owned the biggest department store in town. And Tom and I were roommates in the Beta Theta Pi fraternity house at Missouri. When I got out of the Army, I caught up with Tom in St. Louis. He was working in the shoe department of Butler Brothers. Butler Brothers was a regional retailer with two franchise operations, Federated Stores, a chain of small department stores, and Ben Franklin, a chain of variety stores, what we used to call five and dimes or dime stores. Tom had a great idea, I thought. He and I would become partners, each putting up $20,000 and buy a Federated department store on Delmar Avenue in St. Louis. Helen and I had $5,000 or so, and I knew we could borrow the rest from her father, who always had a lot of faith in me and was very supportive. Man, I was all set to become a big city department store owner. That's when Helen spoke up and laid down the law. Helen Walton. Sam, we've been married 2 years, and we've moved 16 times. Now, I'll go with you any place you want so long as you don't ask me to live in a big city. 10,000 people is enough for me. So any town with a population over 10,000 was off-limits to the Waltons. If you know anything at all about the initial small-town strategy that got Walmart going almost two decades later, you can see that this pretty much set the course for what was to come. She also said no partnerships. They were too risky. Her family had seen some partnerships go sour, and she was dead set in the notion that the only way to go was to work for yourself. So I went back to Butler Brothers to see what else they might have for me. What they had was a Ben Franklin variety store in Newport, Arkansas, a cotton and railroad town of about 7,000 people in the Mississippi River Delta country of eastern Arkansas. I remember riding down there on the train from St. Louis, still wearing my Army uniform with a Sam Brown belt, and walking down Front Street to give this store, my dream, the once-over. A guy from St. Louis owned it, and things weren't working out at all for him. He was losing money, and he wanted to unload the store as fast as he could. I realized now that I was the sucker Butler Brothers sent to save him. I was 27 years old and full of confidence, but I didn't know the first thing about how to evaluate a proposition like this, so I jumped right in with both feet. I bought it for $25,000, $5,000 of our own money, and $20,000 borrowed from Helen's father. My naivete about contracts and such would later come back to haunt me in a big way. But at the time, I was sure Newport and the Ben Franklin had great potential, and I've always believed in goals, so I set myself one. I wanted my little Newport store to be the best, most profitable variety store in Arkansas within 5 years. I felt I had the talent to do it, that it could be done, and why not go for it? Set that as a goal and see if you can't achieve it. If it doesn't work, you've had fun trying. Only after we closed the deal, of course, did I learn that the store was a real dog. It had sales of about $72,000 a year, but its rent was 5% of sales, which I thought sounded fine, but which, it turned out, was the highest rent anybody had ever heard of in the variety store business. No one paid 5% of sales for rent. And it had a strong competitor, a Sterling store across the street, whose excellent manager, John Dunham, was doing more than $150,000 a year in sales, double mine. For all my confidence, I hadn't had a day's experience in running a variety store. So Butler Brothers sent me for 2 weeks' training to the Ben Franklin in Arkadelphia, Arkansas. After that, I was on my own, and we opened for business on September 1, 1945. Our store was a typical old variety store, 50 feet wide and 100 feet deep, facing Front Street in the heart of town, looking out on the railroad tracks. Back then, those stores had cash registers and clerk aisles behind each counter throughout the store, and the clerks would wait on the customers. Self-service hadn't been thought of yet. It was a real blessing for me to be so green and ignorant, because it was from that experience that I learned a lesson which has stuck with me all through the years. You can learn from everybody. I didn't just learn from reading every retail publication I could get my hands on. I probably learned the most from studying what John Dunham was doing across the street. Helen Walton. It turned out there was a lot to learn about running a store. And, of course, what really drove Sam was that competition across the street. John Dunham, over at the Sterling store. Sam was always over there checking on John, always, looking at his prices, looking at his displays, looking at what was going on. He was always looking for a way to do a better job. I don't remember the details, but I remember some kind of panty price war they got into. Later on, long after we'd left Newport and John had retired, we would see him, and he would laugh about Sam always being in his store. But I'm sure it aggravated him quite a bit early on. John had never had good competition before Sam. I learned a tremendous amount from running a store in the Ben Franklin franchise program. They had an excellent operating program for their independent stores, sort of a canned course in how to run a store. It was an education in itself. They had their own accounting system with manuals telling you what to do, when, and how. They had merchandise statements. They had accounts payable sheets. They had profit and loss sheets. They had little ledger books called Beat Yesterday Books, in which you could compare this year's sales with last year's on a day-by-day basis. They had all the tools that an independent merchant needed to run a controlled operation. I had no previous experience in accounting, and I wasn't all that great in accounting in college, so I just did it according to their book. In fact, I used their accounting system long after I'd started breaking their rules on everything else. I even used it for the first 5 or 6 Walmarts. As helpful as that franchise program was to an eager-to-learn 27-year-old kid, Butler Brothers wanted us to do things literally by the book, their book. They really didn't allow their franchisees much discretion. The merchandise was assembled in Chicago, St. Louis, or Kansas City. They told me what merchandise to sell, how much to sell it for, and how much they would sell it to me for. They told me that their selection of merchandise was what the customers expected. They also told me I had to buy at least 80% of my merchandise from them, and if I did, I would get a rebate at year-end. If I wanted to make a 6 or 7% net profit, they told me, I would have to hire so much help and do so much advertising. This is how most franchises work. At the very beginning, I went along and ran my store by their book because I really didn't know any better. But it didn't take me long to start experimenting. That's just the way I am and always have been. Pretty soon, I was laying on promotional programs of my own. And then I started buying merchandise directly from manufacturers. I had lots of arguments with manufacturers. I would say, I want to buy these ribbons and bows direct. I don't want you to sell them to Butler Brothers, and then I have to pay Butler Brothers 25% more for them. I want it direct. Most of the time, they didn't want to make Butler Brothers mad, so they turned me down. Every now and then, though, I would find one who would cross over and do it my way. That was the start of a lot of the practices and philosophies that still prevail at Walmart today. I was always looking for offbeat suppliers or sources. I started driving over to Tennessee to some fellows I found who would give me special buys at prices way below what Ben Franklin was charging me. One, I remember, was Wright Merchandising Company in Union City, which would sell to small businesses like mine at good wholesale prices. I'd work in the store all day, then take off around closing and drive that windy road over to the Mississippi River Ferry at Cottonwood Point, Missouri, and then into Tennessee with an old homemade trailer hitched to my car. I'd stuff that car and trailer with whatever I could get good deals on, usually on soft lines, ladies' panties and nylons, men's shirts, and I'd bring them back, price them low, and just blow that stuff out of the store. I've got to tell you, it drove the Ben Franklin folks crazy. Not only were they not getting their percentages, they couldn't compete with the prices I was buying at. Then I started branching out further than Tennessee. Somehow or another, I got in touch by letter with a manufacturer's agent out of New York named Harry Weiner. He ran Weiner Buying Services at 505 7th Avenue. That guy ran a very simple business. He would go to all these different manufacturers and then list what they had for sale. When somebody like me sent him an order, he would take maybe 5% for himself and then send the order on to the factory, which would ship it to us. That 5% seemed like a pretty reasonable cut to me compared to 25% for Ben Franklin. I'll never forget one of Harry's deals, one of the best items I ever had, and an early lesson in pricing. It first got me thinking in the direction of what eventually would become the foundation of Walmart's philosophy. If you're interested in how Walmart did it, this is one story you've got to sit up and pay close attention to. Harry was selling ladies' panties, two-barred tricot satin panties with an elastic waist, for $2 a dozen. We'd been buying similar panties from Ben Franklin for $2.50 a dozen and selling them at 3 pair for a dollar. Well, at Harry's price of $2, we could put them out at 4 for a dollar and make a great promotion for our store. Here's the simple lesson we learned, which others were learning at the same time and which eventually changed the way retailers sell and customers buy all across America. Say I bought an item for 80 cents. I found that by pricing it at a dollar, I could sell three times more of it than by pricing it at $1.20. I might make only half the profit per item, but because I was selling three times as many, the overall profit was much greater. Simple enough. But this is really the essence of discounting. By cutting your price, you can boost your sales to a point where you earn far more at the cheaper retail price than you could have by selling the item at the higher price. In retailer language, you can lower your markup but earn more because of the increased volume. I began to mull this idea in Newport, but it would be another 10 years before I took it seriously. I couldn't follow up on it in Newport because the Ben Franklin program was too cut and dried to permit it. And despite my dealings with the likes of Harry Weiner, I still had that contract saying I was supposed to buy at least 80% of my merchandise from Ben Franklin. If I missed that target, I didn't get my year-end rebate. The fact of the matter is, I stretched that contract every way I could. I would buy as much as I could on the outside and still try to meet the 80%. Charlie Baum, who was then one of the field men for Ben Franklin, would say we were only at 70%, and I would foam at the mouth and rant and rave about it. I guess the only reason Butler Brothers didn't give me a harder time about it all is that our store had quickly gone from being a laggard to one of the top performers in our district. Things began to clip along pretty good in Newport in a very short time. After only 2.5 years, we had paid back the $20,000 Helen's father loaned us, and I felt mighty good about that. It meant the business had taken off on its own, and I figured we were really on our way now. We tried a lot of promotional things that worked really well. First, we put a popcorn machine out on the sidewalk, and we sold that stuff like crazy. So I thought and thought about it, and finally decided what we needed was a soft ice cream machine out there, too. I screwed my courage up and went down to the bank and borrowed what at the time seemed like the astronomical sum of $1,800 to buy that thing. That was the first money I ever borrowed from a bank. Then we rolled the ice cream machine out there on the sidewalk next to the popcorn machine. And I mean we attracted some attention with those two. It was new and different. Another experiment. And we really turned a profit on it. I paid off that $1,800 note in 2 or 3 years, and I felt great about it. I really didn't want to be remembered as the guy who lost his shirt on some crazy ice cream machine. Charlie Baum. Everybody wanted to go see Sam Walton's store. We never had another store that had a ding-dong ice cream bar in it, one of those ice cream-making machines. People went there for that, and it was fantastic. But one Saturday night, for some reason, they forgot to clean that machine up when they closed, and I went by there the next day with some of my clients to show them Sam's front window. And I want to tell you, the flies in that window were just out of this world. As good as business was, I never could leave well enough alone, and in fact, I think my constant fiddling and meddling with the status quo may have been one of my biggest contributions to the later success of Walmart. As I mentioned, we faced Front Street, and our biggest competitor, John Dunham's Sterling store, was across Hazel Street on the other corner. His store was slightly smaller than ours, but he still managed to do twice as much business as our store did before we bought it. We were coming on strong, though. In our first year, the Ben Franklin did $105,000 in sales, compared to $72,000 under the old owner. Then the next year was $140,000, and then $175,000. Finally, we caught and then passed old John over there across Hazel Street. But next door to him, on the other side from us, was a Kroger grocery store. By now, I was real involved in the community and kept my ear to the ground pretty good, and I heard that Sterling was going to buy Kroger's lease and expand John's store into that space, making their store much bigger than mine. So I hustled down to Hot Springs to find the landlady of that Kroger building. Somehow, I convinced her to give me the lease instead of giving it to Sterling. I didn't have any idea what I was going to do with it, but I sure knew I didn't want Sterling to have it. Well, I decided to put in a small department store. Now, Newport already had several department stores.